The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 030737, the Coca-Cola Bottling Company and Others versus Armor Bottling Company and Others from Morris County and the 6th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 031050, Kroger Texas Limited Partnership and Robert Moody versus Teresa Subaru from Dallas County and the 5th Court of Appeals District. And 040728, Fairfield Insurance Company versus Stevens Martin Paving, LP, and others, which is here on a certified question from the United States Court of Appeals for the 5th Circuit. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side, and we expect to conclude these arguments by noon. The court will take a brief recess between each argument. The proceedings are being recorded, and the parties may contact the clerk's office for a copy of the arguments. There are currently two vacancies on the court, but we expect there will be an announcement this morning on one of them, and we expect the other to be filled in the near future. The court is ready to hear argument in 030737, the Coca-Cola Bottling Company and Others versus Harmer Bottling Company and Others.
May it please the court, Mr. Jerry Bean and Mr. John Jacobson will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Jacobson will open with the first 8 minutes. Mr. Bean will present the rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is John Jacobson. I represent the Coca-Cola Company. I'll present our argument that petitioners did not violate the Texas antitrust law. Mr. Bean will argue the other points raised in our briefs. It's important to keep the agreements in this case in perspective. CMAs are not exclusive dealing agreements. Every retailer stocks Pepsi and other competing soft drink brands. Even in cases not like this one, where large numbers of retailers agree not to carry any competing products at all, most antitrust claims fail because substantial foreclosure has not been shown. Here we're dealing with agreements that involve no exclusive dealing, just exclusive displays and advertising. Many decisions have addressed the legality of these types of promotional agreements. The Gruma case, the Louisa case, the beverage management case, RJR, Bayou Bottle. Every single one of those decisions has flatly rejected claims that the agreements violated the antitrust laws.
The respondent says these are different because of the terms of the agreements. The Court of Appeals is persuaded by that. Do you think these kinds of agreements could have an anti-competitive effect?
Justice Hecht, all agreements are different. Each of the CMAs in this case was different one to the other. The degree of exclusivity in these agreements is no different than those in the other cases. For example, in the Bayou Bottling case, the defendant, also a Coke Dr. Pepper bottler with 75-80% of the market, provided free service for coolers in stores if the coolers were stocked exclusively with Coke products. That's a good deal more restrictive than any of the CMA provisions at issue in this case. The Louisa case similarly involved very, very similar agreements to those at issue here, in that case by a Pepsi bottler, with again 70-plus percent share of the market.
But I suppose if you had one of these agreements and you could trace an anti-competitive effect, whether it be harm to consumers or preclusion in the marketplace, back to the agreement, they could give rise to liability.
That's correct, Justice Eck. We are not arguing that these agreements are legal per se.
And I suppose they could also be used to create or maintain a monopoly.
And we do not deny that. We are simply saying that the hurdle to prove such illegality is necessary and appropriately a high one, because at the end of the day, what these agreements are agreements by Coke to discount its prices and to provide financial benefits to retailers in return for promotional benefits. And we do not want to discourage that type of pro-competitive activity. It lowers prices to consumers. So the hurdle to demonstrate that this sort of agreement violates the Texas antitrust laws is necessarily and appropriately a high one. And it clearly was not met in this case, Your Honor. There was there are two ways to demonstrate that a CMA might violate the antitrust laws. One, by showing substantial foreclosure of a very large percentage of the relevant market. Absolutely no evidence here of foreclosure whatsoever. Plaintiffs never even tried to demonstrate what percentage of the market was even affected by these agreements. Zero evidence of foreclosure.
Is the evidence that Walmart and other markets where terms are different, evidence that conditions there in that store in this area and other stores in other markets, is that some evidence of a foreclosure in this case?
No, Your Honor, it's not evidence of foreclosure at all. There are retailers in this case who declined to take Coke CMAs, who signed up with Pepsi instead. There's the Walmart evidence. They took no CMAs in this market, although they regularly do take CMAs in some other markets and some other product lines. The fact that a store makes this decision to accept or reject a CMA is evidence of nothing, Your Honor. What the plaintiffs would need to show is that a measurable percentage of the market was foreclosed, absolutely didn't even try to demonstrate that here. Or, and this is normally much more difficult proof, demonstrate that there was an effect, direct adverse effect on consumers in the market as a whole, meaning higher prices in the market as a whole, reduced output in the market as a whole, or reduce quality in the market as a whole. And again, there was no effort to demonstrate this in the courts below.
What about the requirement in some of the CMAs that no competitor's product could be priced lower than Coke? Doesn't that, on its face, harm consumers by keeping prices at a certain level?
It doesn't, Your Honor. And agreements having precisely that clause were upheld on summary judgment in the Louisa case. And those provisions are rare, but the fundamental point is that there is nothing in the fact that such agreements existed that demonstrated that prices in the market as a whole increased. It's true that on the featured package in those stores, Coke had to be one, two, or as much as three price points lower on that featured package than competing brands, but nothing would stand in the way of a consumer going across the street to getting the competing brand.
But at that price. Particular store, then, you would agree that it harms consumers on a per-store basis. You're just quibbling with the territory.
I'm quibbling with more than that, Justice. The effect needs to be on the market. The fact that a consumer in one store pays a higher price is not close to evidence of a market effect.
Let's say that 60% of the stores had this term in it. Now, I realize that they don't, but or 70% had this particular term in it, that no one can be priced below Coke products. Would that be a different case?
If there were evidence that the effect, and there was nothing close to that here, but if there was evidence that the effect was to cause prices on average or in general in the marketplace to increase, that would be an adverse effect on competition. But plaintiffs never attempted such proof. They tried to just focus on individual vignettes, on 20-ounce beverages, flavored beverages, grape, root beer, orange, provisions like this that affected a particular product at a particular period of time. They never met or came close to trying to meet their fundamental burden of proof, which is to demonstrate that the market as a whole was affected. That is the fundamental flaw that impacted.
How many markets were involved in this case?
Your Honor, the plaintiffs say that each of their individual RC territories was a relevant geographic market. It's our position that that argument is invalid as a matter of law. It defines a geographic market on the basis of 5% of the sales in the market, those being of RC brands. It ignores the sales of Coca-Cola. It ignores the sales of Pepsi-Cola. The market as a whole was not defined appropriately by the plaintiffs in the case.
I haven't looked. Yeah, it's a large record, but even with the jury charge, did you separate out the market areas and get jury questions on each market, or was it all lumped together and the jury just heard these snippets from different markets and answered one question about the whole case?
The jury was appropriately charged, Your Honor, on the standards for defining a relevant geographic market, but in fact, the liability determinations were made on the basis of lumping together. There were determinations for damages for each of the particular plaintiffs, Your Honor, but the liability, everything was lumped together. That's one of the vices of the entire case. My time has expired. I want to thank the court for hearing me today. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, I am Jerry Bean. I represent the petitioner of Coca-Cola Enterprises. I'm going to be addressing two issues. First, the lack of legally sufficient evidence to support an award of damages, and second, the application in this case of the Texas Free Enterprise Antitrust Act to out-of-state effect. We will rely on our brief with respect to the other issues.
Could I ask you about the second one first?
Yes, sir.
There's a provision, there's a sentence kind of peculiarly placed in the statute that says that the legislature intended to exercise its power to the full extent permitted under the U.S. and Texas constitutions. Why doesn't that trump the sort of vague purpose clause up at the beginning of the statute?
For two reasons, Your Honor. If you look at the purpose clause or the purpose paragraph, that paragraph goes further and says this act shall be construed to accomplish this purpose. So it is more than just a purpose. It is a legislative statement that the legislature wants the act, mandatory, shall be construed to accomplish this purpose. And I think as a statutory interpretation principle, you know, the court tries to give effect to each provision of the statute, and I think the provision I just mentioned is the one that governs in this situation.
If the briefs don't really deal with this very much, do you think there are constitutional limitations on, apart from the effect on interstate commerce, of how far the state statute could go in regulating anti-competitive behavior?
Your Honor, I think there are constitutional limitations on how far a statute could go. I would submit that the legislature did not cross that line in this situation, because the legislature very clearly states, and this court observed in the Collar Times case, that the purpose of the statute is to protect Texas consumers. Okay. And in this case, we sort of have a somewhat unusual situation, maybe. The effects of these promotional agreements are felt within the confines of a grocery store or convenience store. I mean, that's where the displays occur, that's where the shelf space occurs, that's where the promotional activity occurs. And what takes place in a grocery store or convenience store in Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana, and we have 29 counties and parishes in those three states that are implicated here, and just as a way of observation, we only have 11 Texas counties, 29 of those in this case, but the effect in those out-of-state stores is totally separable from the effect in a Texas store.
Do those states all have similar statutes?
Your Honor, they do have antitrust statutes. I cannot.
So I suppose it's your position that the sales in each state would be governed by the antitrust statutes of those states.
That is correct, Your Honor. And specifically, our position is that in this case, the Texas Act was held to apply to those out-of-state territories, And our position is that's erroneous.
Your client moved to apply the law of those states?
No, sir. Our position was and still is, Your Honor, that the law of the state of Texas does not apply in those territories, period, stop.
What? Texas Blue Sky Law prohibits a Texas seller from selling an unregistered security in New York. Why can't its antitrust law prohibit anti-competitive behavior by a Texas business or someone operating in Texas in a neighboring state or somewhere else?
Two reasons, Your Honor. First, the statutory language limits its scope and application by its focus on Texas consumers. And I submit, you know, somebody who buys a soft drink in a convenience store in Northwest Arkansas is not a Texas consumer. And that's the very facts that we have in this case. That's what happened here. We have been enjoined from having our Arkansas employees go to a local store in Arkansas and negotiate an agreement that has an effect only in Arkansas. The second reason I would submit, Your Honor, if the court deals with any constitutional issues, I think it's a statutory interpretation issue that the court is trying to look at and not get into constitutional infirmities. But in the circumstance we have here, what the trial court has done and the Court of Appeals have upheld is said, here is Texas competition policy. We're going to apply it to conduct and particularly effects that take place totally out of state.
CCE does business in Texas, but it's not a Texas company.
That is true.
And it does business a whole lot of other places.
It does, absolutely. It does. But the effects, we have cited four cases, Your Honor, by other courts dealing with their state statutes, state antitrust statutes. Every court looks at the effect, the location of the effect of the conduct. And I would commend the court the Florida case. Florida conduct affects outside the state of Florida. Florida court says Florida Act does not apply.
So what would be the result if we were to agree with you? If you look at the market for purposes of foreclosure, and that market has to be defined beyond the borders of the state, you'd say you look at the three-state region to prove market foreclosure, but then you only apply the injunction within the borders of Texas? What's the relevance of the market determination vis-a-vis the scope of the injunction?
Let me approach it this way, Your Honor. As Mr. Jacobson said, it's been the plaintiff's position that the geographic area that they contract to distribute RC products in is a separate geographic area. That's their theory in this case. We have three of those that are totally outside the state of Texas.
And none are totally inside.
One.
One is totally inside.
One is totally inside. And then we have two that are cross-border.
How would you define the market that you believe they have to prove was foreclosed?
Well, we would define the market, Your Honor, as much broader than, I'll use the phrase, the Arklatex area that's been thrown around in this case, for the simple fact that the evidence in the case is undisputed that certain retailers have to go as far as Dallas or New Orleans or San Antonio to get product that could be in the relevant market. So our definition of the relevant market is substantially different than the plaintiff's.
So your definition of the market would be what? I'm not sure I understood.
It's a regional geographic market whose boundaries at least go to Dallas and to San Antonio.
And would it include the Arkansas-Louisiana region?
The issue in this case, yes, it would.
So you think that the market for purposes of measuring foreclosure is much broader than the one here?
Absolutely.
But so the court has to look at that, but then in fashioning the injunction, it can only apply to Texas.
I think my time is up, but I'll respond to the question this way. I don't think the court has to look at what the defendants say the market is. I think all the court has to look at is where the out-of-state territories are located, regardless of a geographic market, and look and see that the act was applied for both damages and injunctive relief.
I understand that, okay. But I mean, I'm trying to figure out what you think would be a proper way to try a case like this. And you say larger reason to prove market foreclosure, but the injunction can only go within the borders of Texas.
That's right.
So you can prove anti-competitive or foreclosure of a much larger market, but your injunction can only affect this piece.
That's true. There's nothing to prevent the plaintiffs from utilizing the laws of other states or the federal antitrust laws if the Texas Antitrust Act doesn't reach a particular area. Not a thing in the world would prevent that.
Thank you, Your Honor. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Warren Harris will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. This is not a case about the illegality of CMAs that are commonly used in the market. The CMAs at issue here were only used in this market where Coke had the number one and number two brands, both Coke and Dr. Pepper.
If we were to determine that market foreclosure was a key piece of this type of claim, do you lose?
No, Judge. And that moves me to the monopoly claim. This case was tried as a monopoly case. We've not heard one word about monopoly today. Substantial foreclosure is not an element of either an attempt to monopolize or a conspiracy to monopolize.
But as charged to the jury, you had to show that it harmed overall competition in the relevant market. And to me, your brief cites anecdotal type incidents. Where's your evidence of overall competition?
Judge, the harm to the market is both in higher prices being charged as well as reduced consumer choice.
But again, you cite here, but where's your, like, the big picture kind of prices worth higher overall for these periods of time in this market, the percentages, the, I mean, you cited at least what looks like anecdotal evidence that's spotty.
Well, there is evidence cited in our brief by Coca-Cola that during the same period, over a several-year period, that while their volume went down, their prices went up. There's testimony by the bottlers that after the CMAs were signed, prices went up. We have terms of the CMA that require higher prices. We heard about a Coke product having to be one or two or three price points lower. Each one of those is a dime. That's saying a Coke product has to be up to 30 cents lower than an RC product, regardless of the wholesale price.
The brief says that only applied in 1% of the cases, so it didn't really have a market effect.
I believe that was, I think that was on the exclusive flavor agreements, and that's where they're playing with the numbers. They want to take the exclusive flavor agreements in convenience stores and then look at the overall market, but when you look at convenience stores, it was about 7% of sales that it kicked our products totally out of. And that's just one of the terms. I mean, it's the whole list of terms. It starts with the CMAs, all of them, for 42 to 52 weeks.
So what's the overall impact? I mean, I can't find it now, but I thought your brief was talking about 30-cent difference was just in some convenience stores in Paris, Texas, and it wasn't. Where's the evidence that this was pervasive in the market, and what was the substantial impact on the market?
That was in the entire Paris market for a two-year period. It was in four chains entirely. It was the Easy Mart chain, the Circle K chain, the Winn-Dixie chain, and the Total Petroleum chain. And that's one of the pieces. I mean, that's where that had the most effect in those markets. But some of the other things were over the entire
market. But where's the evidence as the other markets?
For that particular item, that's the only evidence is in those markets. But the other items are in all the CMA agreements, like the exclusive ads. That affected every market. It affected every store that had a CMA. Because all the CMAs were a 42 to 52-week period, and the exclusive ads were more than just running the ad in the newspaper. It dealt with outside-of-store advertising, like banners and convenience
again,
stores.
Again, the charge that required you to show restraint harmed overall competition in the relevant market. And we can theorize that it might have, but where are the numbers that show that it did?
Judge, there is not a specific percentage in the record, and we're not required to do that. The Supreme Court in Tampa Electric only requires a showing of a substantial share of the relevant market restraint.
And so what is the share? How do you quantify a substantial share unless you put some sort of parameters on it?
I don't believe we're required to put a particular number on it. That is the fact issue for the jury, whether this is a substantial share of the market that was foreclosed. That's the fact issue that went to the jury. That's the fact issue that the jury determined based on all these CMA provisions. The ones that required that we couldn't even put a shelf talker. You couldn't even put anything at the point of sale showing that our products had a lower price. That foreclosed competition, that was in every one of the CMAs.
I just want to be clear. You seem to say at one point that substantial foreclosure or actual harm to consumers must be shown for restraint of trade, at least, and to at least a lesser extent, perhaps, monopolization. And then your position is a much lesser or maybe not at all for attempt to monopolize.
And conspiracy, not at all on those two claims.
But later you say that harm to competitors results in harm to competition, which I kind of see how that could be. And maybe that's enough to show liability, but then you wouldn't have to show substantial foreclosure. I'm unclear about your position on substantial foreclosure.
You're exactly right. We have to show substantial foreclosure for restraint of trade, which is Section 1 of the Sherman Act under the Texas Act. For an actual monopolization claim, there's a lesser requirement of substantial foreclosure, but it's still there. For an attempt to monopolize, as well as conspiracy to monopolize, there is no requirement of substantial foreclosure, because in both of those cases, the elements are different, and you don't have the actual monopolization. That's the restraint, and that is the substantial foreclosure that takes place. The Fifth Circuit in 2000, the Johnston's case, which is cited in the brief, talks about attempted monopolization and sets out how the elements are different. It said it's where someone has the power to do it, but yet the monopolization hasn't actually exerted its efforts on the market.
Well, let me ask, this is basic, I guess, but if your claim is attempted monopolization, how does that go to your damages in the sense that it seems like they just attempted and they haven't harmed you yet, they're just on their way to getting a monopoly? How does that dovetail with the, I guess this case was tried with all these theories and then got one damages number. How did the jury figure out what the appropriate damages were?
The jury looked at the impact on sales by the conduct in the market through the CMAs and looked at all that conduct together.
So attempted means more than it seems. They accomplished something.
Under the antitrust cases, that's right. You can still get damages because then you look at the harm that's actually happened to you without a showing of the market-wide analysis of the harm. That's why you don't have the requirement of substantial foreclosure. It can harm you without having that effect in the overall market. That's the distinction of the elements in those cases.
How does petitioner's assertion that the CMAs were terminable on short notice and without penalty affect your argument? If other competitors could come in and offer better terms, better conditions, and the retailers could freely terminate and change, how does that undermine, or does it undermine, in your opinion, your monopoly and restraint of trade argument?
It affects it in that is one factor to be considered under the rule of reason. It should also be noted that many of the CMAs here were 2 years or longer. Many of them didn't have the termination provisions, so that argument isn't even applicable to a large number of the CMAs. But the most important thing is, on this evidence, CMAs were not being terminated. There's evidence of one grocery store, one convenience store chain that terminated a CMA. Coke retaliated. Coke started charging that chain the full wholesale price when it was the only store in the market being charged that price. Another store, the Brookshire's chain in Atlanta, wanted a less stringent CMA. What did it get? It got higher prices. Coke raised its prices to the point that Brookshire's had to sell 2-liter Coke for $2.37 a 2-liter, when at the same time they were selling Pepsi's for 99 cents. That's just one factor to be taken into account in the overall analysis, but the most important thing is here, it wasn't happening because Coke was exerting its monopoly power with the 75 to 80% control of the market and making retailers do things they wouldn't have done by free choice. That's one of the things a monopolist can do in the market. And the record has testimony of several of the retailers that said, no, we would have liked to have had a CMA with lesser weeks like they do in other markets. We don't want these exclusives. But we can't not have the CMA with Coke because they have the number one and number two brands, and we can't be competitive with others in the market.
Approximately how many of these CMAs were 52 weeks in duration?
I can't break it down on exactly how many were 52, but all of them were between 42 and 52. And then you take out that there are some weeks that in the trade they just don't advertise. There are 3 or 4 weeks that for whatever reason they just don't put ads out. So you even have to take the 42 weeks and move it up. And there's evidence in the record that Pepsi and its CMA programs wouldn't even try to go in with a six-week CMA. They wanted at least 16 weeks or so. So even though it may have been as little as 42 weeks, that still foreclosed any other competitor coming in with a meaningful CMA program.
We got some amicus briefs about focused on comedy and constitutional problems. Were those issues raised in the trial court or court appeal?
There was nothing along those lines raised in the court of appeals, and those were raised on the issue of the extraterritorial application of the act.
So what's your view about whether this court should address those?
This court should not address it because it's not before the court. And that is the bound of the Texas Antitrust Act that Justice Heck said. In 1525B, there's that second sentence, and it says that the act will only be limited by the bounds of the Texas Constitution and the Constitution of the United States.
But that's what choice of law issues go to, those the balance between the states and one state telling another state what to do. Why does, if the anti-competitive effect is in Oklahoma, why should we apply the Texas statute? Just because the person that made the decision is standing in Texas when they decide if the entire harm in a fraud case, consumer fraud case or a regular fraud case, choice of law principles clearly say where you're defrauded, where you were lied, where you were misled. But that you're saying the antitrust laws are different.
Judge, that's right here because you have to look at the reach of the act. And the legislature has made it clear the reach of this act will be as far as the Constitution allows.
Statute nowhere says this applies to sales outside Texas.
It does not say that expressly, but it does contemplate
that. So you're saying because the Constitution might allow it, therefore it was the legislature's intent to do it. They certainly didn't say that, did they?
They did not say that it would apply out of state directly, no, sir. But at the same time, the Act does say that it's no defense under the Act that it involves interstate commerce. And it does say that the bounds are going to be the Constitution. That issue's not been raised here. Koch says the boundaries.
If we were to say this is illegal conduct under our statute, and then Oklahoma says, no, it's just fine in the Oklahoma counties, what are we going to do? Should we flip a coin or have a gunfight like they did on the stuff and land and out in El Paso? How are we going to settle this if Oklahoma says it's fine and we say it's not? It is, after all, their state outside our boundaries.
Judge, they should have brought forth evidence of what Oklahoma law was, and they never did that.
So your argument that it's okay to apply it outside the state is because they never asked for the application of Oklahoma law?
They never proved that it was any different, and if there's no evidence it's any different, we presume it's the same. This case was submitted under Texas law. There was no objection to the jury charge as to the application of Texas law at the charge conference. And because of that, we have to presume it's the same. Otherwise, there's no harm analysis. We don't know what Oklahoma law is. We don't know what Louisiana law is because that evidence wasn't presented at the trial court.
Can I return to Justice Owen's question earlier? She was asking about what the evidence of the substantial share was, and you said, well, there's enough of the jury to make a determination, but shouldn't we have some idea of the entire pie in order to review the jury's finding? And it sounds like you haven't, and I haven't looked at the record yet, but there's not the level of specificity that would give us a basis for making that determination.
Well, Judge, where you have these many markets and all these factors, I think that's where it has to be determined on a very factual intensive basis, looking at all the different factors, all the elements of the CMAs, and whether that had an impact on a substantial share, and that's the exact phrase used by the U.S. Supreme Court,
right,
a substantial share of the relevant market. And very often in these cases, it's not quantified. Two of the most significant antitrust cases in the last several years are the Conwood case, which is cited in the briefs, in the LePage's case. Both of those cases, there were finding of antitrust violations under the Sherman Act. Both of those cases were affirmed by the federal courts of appeals. Both of those cases were cert denied. In neither is there any evidence of a percentage number of foreclosure. It's just not required under the antitrust laws. That's the fact issue determining a substantial share. And the jury has to weigh all of that evidence together and to see if this had an impact on the substantial share of the market.
It's one thing to get your prove up your case and get your damages. In this case, you tripled those damages. And what the requirement, is there any Texas case law on the level of intent, I guess it would be, that's required to triple those damages?
The test under the Texas Act is willful and flagrant. Under the federal act, I believe there's an automatic trebling, but you do have to have an additional finding under the Texas Act.
And there are like, what, 9 or 10 markets in this case?
There are 5 different bottlers with their geographic markets, so roughly the 5 markets together collectively the Arklatex region.
And so, I mean, once again, I'm not sure how this case is tried, but it seems like, what evidence did you have that Coca-Cola, I guess, would know that what they were doing was a violation of antitrust laws?
Well,
in each market or for each bottler, or was it just, it seemed what I read in the brief was just a few or, you know, a couple of instances where somebody at Coke, presumably unidentified is what the brief said that they shouldn't be doing this kind of thing. Is that all you have? Or, I mean, it just seems like a tough burden to show that.
Some of the evidence is market-wide, some of it is not. Things like targeting 7-Up. Coke decided it wanted Sprite to be the number one brand in the lemon-lime flavor, and it went out and specifically targeted 7-Up. And there's evidence in the record, evidence that's cited in our brief about things they did to go out to try to get the 7-Up shelf space reduced to try to increase Sprite in the market. There's evidence that one of the bottlers continued to have good sales with flavors, and Coke had meetings where they specifically talked about targeting him and his flavor sales through exclusive flavor agreements and the like in his area to try to put him out of business.
That's okay, though, isn't it?
Not for a monopolist to go in and use exclusive. For a monopolist to go in and use these exclusive agreements whenever, again, they've got the power to make retailers do things that a retailer wouldn't normally do. And sometimes a monopolist can't do things that a ordinary competitor could do. That's been clearly recognized by the cases because you don't have the same checks and balances in the market. The monopolist has such a share of the market that it can exert that force and do things like buy out shelf space. The bottlers took over after Coke released the rights to Sunkist, to Welch's, to A&W Root Beer. What did Coke do? Coke said, get those out of the store. We want to put Barks on the shelf, Barks Root Beer, which has no market share. We want to put Minute Maid flavors on the store. A monopolist can do that because they can say, we've got Coke, we've got Dr. Pepper, we've got 80% of this market. We want our flavors in your store. And that's exactly how they got those flavors in, through the use of these CMAs. They bought that shelf space when it didn't exist and put the number one selling brands in each of those 3 flavors off the shelf. That has harmed the competition. That reduced consumer choice. The evidence in the record also shows there's harm to competition by rising prices. The easy way to look at what happened without the CMAs is to go look at Walmart. In Walmart, the bottlers did just fine in competition. They held their sales. They held their shelf space. They could introduce new products. They could get all of their products on the shelf. They couldn't do this against these CMAs because of the anti-competitive effects. But they could do that at Walmart, where they had a level playing field and didn't have to deal with that. That is evidence of the harm to the market caused by these anti-competitive CMAs. For these reasons, this court should affirm the judgments of the lower courts.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Jerry Bean again for the petitioners. I would commend to the court an exhibit. It is CCE Exhibit 409. It is a colored map of the territories in issue in this case. The plaintiff's claim is that each separate colored territory is a separate geographic market. Each of those is separate. That's their claim. That's their theory. It always has been. It still is. Okay. With respect to your question, Justice O'Neill, an individual store is not a market. We just heard a discussion about Walmart. Walmart is not a market. A group of convenience stores or a group of grocery stores, is not a market. And the fundamental problem in this case with the plaintiff's proof is what they have is evidence of an agreement in green in 1 year affecting a couple of stores, and then a couple of years later, evidence of another agreement in blue affecting a couple of stores. They present it to the jury and stand in front of the court and say, that's evidence of foreclosure. What that is that's evidence of agreements. It's not evidence of foreclosure.
Well, of course, they say they don't need evidence of foreclosure for an attempted monopoly claim. Do you disagree with that?
Well, they're simply wrong. And I would tell the court that the Bruma case, the R.J. Reynolds case, the Louisa case, all of which deal with promotional agreements and the soft drink industry or other consumer products, all had monopoly claims in them. All of those cases found that the challenge agreements did not violate the antitrust laws. And I would point out one other thing to the court, if I can step over here for a moment. The jury was charged in this case specifically that one of the elements of attempt to monopolize is predatory or anti-competitive conduct. With respect to conspiracy to monopolize, the jury was charged that what has to happen is something more than conduct of a business that is part of the normal competitive process. So the element of engaging in something that substantially impacts competition was specifically in the jury charge in this case and unobjected to. So the case law says they have to show foreclosure in monopoly cases. The jury charge reflected that.
Do you agree that you have monopoly power in some of these markets?
Your Honor, the issue of monopoly power is not before the court. We don't believe we have monopoly power. This is a very unusual situation, and I will admit it. My client purchased a series of local bottlers. Each of those bottlers was distributing Coke and Dr. Pepper at the time of the purchase. So we bought into this share. What is unusual about this is, as the plaintiff's economist admitted, Pepsi-Cola is in the market with a share of, and I don't want to mistake this, 14 or 15%, and the economist specifically testified that Pepsi-Cola has the power to restrain prices that the defendants might charge. It's very unusual, and my time is up, and I'll finish here. It's very unusual when you have a party with this market share where I can stand before the court and say we don't have monopoly power, but that is the reason I feel comfortable in saying. Thank you very much. My time is up.
Thank you. That concludes the argument, and the court will now take a brief break.